farm staff.
Good morning. September 14th. Welcome to the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. We have a fascinating agenda today, so let's go ahead and dive in. We're going to go slightly out of order, colleagues, due to traffic delays on the road. And we're going to start with the Integrated Water Resources Strategy update. So I'd like to call forward Brenda Baden and Phil Ward. 16 loads of
Mr. Chair, do you think it's wise to have them both at the same time?
Remains to be seen.
All right.
Yeah.
Good morning. Good morning, co-chairs and members. It's good to be with you this morning. For the record, my name is Phil Ward, Director of the Oregon Water Resources Department, and with me is Brenda Bateman, our senior policy person who was our lead person on this little effort. We've talked to you before about Oregon's Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and so we're here to give you a bit of an update since our commission actually adopted the first version of this strategy at their meeting this last month. And so we now have an adopted strategy for your perusal this morning. And Brenda's going to give you the detail on that. But when you're ready, Brenda, I can put up that first slide. I'll do my little bit. So this was a project that was, you will remember, was launched by you all in 2009. And we were charged, our department was charged with creating a strategy to meet, to understand and meet Oregon's water needs for the years ahead. And we weren't supposed to do that all on our own. We were supposed to do it in cooperation with other state natural resource agencies, with the stakeholder community, which, as you know, is deeply engaged in water resource issues here in Oregon, and with our federal partners as well. So this was a comprehensive charge you gave us in 2009, and we got a modest budget appropriation to do that, a couple staff people that have assisted Brenda, and we had great cooperation from other state agencies in this effort. Why don't you give me that next slide? So this is an effort, and again, I'm just introducing things, and Brenda's going to give you the meat this morning. But here's some of the things I just mentioned. We actually had an 18-member policy advisory group made up of the stakeholder community that is invested in the water resource issues in our state. It was a diverse group, as you can imagine, but in the end, the group came up with some key recommended actions that Brenda's going to highlight with you this morning that enjoyed the support of the entire policy advisory group. We had an 18-member, what we called state agency advisory group. So without any compensation, our partner state agencies that have an interest in water, both from the economic end and from the conservation end, volunteered to assist in this process and met regularly with Brenda and her team. We had a 10-member federal liaison group, so the major federal agencies that work in water here in Oregon assisted us in this process regularly. We had great cooperation. And the group I think that needs the most credit here for this is the core team that Brenda put together, consisting of staff from the Department of Environmental Quality, our agency, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Agriculture, who each dedicated a staff person, not full-time of course, but dedicated a staff person to work and assist in developing this issue. So Brenda's going to carry on and tell you what really is in the document, but I just wanted to remind us all that this was a comprehensive effort. It took about 3 years and it had a heck of a lot of people engaged in it.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and I served as the project manager for the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. This document that we'll be talking about this afternoon is available on our website, and if the committee members would like, we could also provide hard copy to members if you'd like that. Hard copies are also available to the public to order through our website. Today we wanted to walk through the recommended actions that are in this strategy, and you have a one-page summary that's been provided to you affectionately called the placemat for its size. And we wanted to walk through recommended action.
Mr. Chair, early drafts to this are now in use by Brenda's children as placemats at the evening dinner table.
Thank you.
Glad to see recycling is happening.
There are 13 different issue areas in which we have recommended actions, and so given the time this morning, we wanted to walk briskly through those and also highlight those that you're likely to see come before you again in 2013 with either a budget or a policy request attached to it coming from this strategy. If I could direct your attention to the top left quadrant of this page, you'll see that the focus there is on data, specifically on the physical water resources of the state, and I would say that this area is the one that received the broadest support from our policy advisory group members, from citizen members and stakeholders. No matter their perspective on water, everyone agreed we need to have the best information we possibly can in order to move forward and make the types of decisions and develop the types of projects that we're talking about with this strategy. So there are three recommended actions in this quadrant that we wanted to bring to you this morning, and they're all focused on water. There's a heavy focus on groundwater. Recommended action 1A is to conduct additional groundwater investigations. These are formal investigations that our department conducts in partnership and cost share with the USGS. And while we've looked at several areas of the state already, there are more to go. And there are important questions there to be asked, such as where is the groundwater, how much is there, what kind of pumping is sustainable, what is its interaction with surface water. And I would say that that may be one of the biggest recommendations that's coming from this strategy. Also related to data, you'll see recommended action 1B, and five agencies that worked on this project have requests that relate to this recommended action. It has to do with getting a better handle on both our surface water resources and our groundwater resources, getting gauges in place, monitoring wells in place, and the personnel and staff needed to collect, process, and share that data. That's both on the water quantity and the water quality side. And then you may note with interest recommended action 1C, which has to do with coordinating data. We know how important that is and also how difficult it is, and we have an interagency request in on that topic as well. If you could move your attention across the page to the top right quadrant, this continues a focus on data, but now we're looking at water demands rather than the physical water supplies of the state. And here we have broken this down into two areas. We call them out-of-stream needs. This is where you remove water from the environment for a more consumptive use, such as drinking water, irrigated agriculture, municipal and industrial uses. And those are compared to in-stream uses where the water is left in the environment for beneficial use. On the out-of-stream category, there are a couple of items there I'd draw your attention to. This idea of recapitalizing a cost-share measurement fund that we've had in place for a while to help folks get measurement devices where they need to be, and also to reestablish a position at the Water Resources Department to help water users fulfill their reporting requirements that remain in place today. The other thing that's up there that I'd like to point out is recommended action 2D, updating water right records. We have outdated records that we need to modernize and actually need your permission to do so. And finally, we're proud to point out recommended action 2E was a discussion about updating our water-related permitting guide. When new developers or new businesses come to Oregon, they're often looking for a one-stop shop or some sort of guidance document that talks about the permits that they'll need related to water. Over the summer, our interagency group updated that permitting guide that hadn't been touched since 2008. Now the online links work, now the contact information is correct, and that currently resides on Department of State Lands website. When it comes to in-stream needs, there's an interagency request here as well. Department of Fish and Wildlife has partnered with Water Resources Department to put forward a request for this next year to get better science in place so that we understand the in-stream flows that are needed to support both biological functions and channel maintenance flows. And so you'll hear more about that likely in the 2013 session. Next, I wanted to draw your attention to the bottom left quadrant of this paper. The legislature in 2009 asked us to take account of emerging pressures. What kinds of things will affect both our water demands and our water supplies? There's a lot of meat in here. I'm going to fly through this because work is underway. This work is staged, and we do not have specific requests coming forward in this block in 2013. That work is continuing, and you're likely to see new budget requests or new policy requests in these areas coming in 2015. So this work will continue as it is with no new requests. But I did want to show you what's in here. There's a section on water and energy, which you'll hear a little bit more about later. But the water-energy relationship is very strong and not insignificant. There's a section as well in here on climate change. You may be aware that there are very good efforts underway under Phil Moat's shop at OSU. He's with the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute. They are currently localizing a lot of information that's already been collected. And when they're done with that process, we plan to engage there and help communities understand that information and adapt accordingly. Another piece that's in here is water and land use. No specific recommendations coming out of this section for 2013, or no specific requests, but I will say the groundwater data that we talked about a few minutes ago is key to making sure that land use planners and decision makers in this area have what they need to move forward. Infrastructure is always a big ticket item and is always an ongoing conversation, primarily with the federal agencies. And Business Oregon, Oregon Health Authority, and DEQ are the major players in this area. Finally, we had a section on education and outreach. Again, those efforts continue forward, but I do think it's important to note one key element that we found in the section that was concerning to us. And that was the coming wave of retirements that we see in the water and wastewater treatment sectors, with some estimates showing that professionals in this area may, up to a third of them, may plan to retire within the next 5 to 10 years. And the training that's available for their certifications and licensing programs is not terribly robust here in Oregon. So just something to be thinking about. We go into more detail in our text narrative. And finally, skipping over to the last quadrant there, the bottom left, this is entitled Meeting Our In-Stream and Out-of-Stream Water Needs. This includes many of the tangible projects that you may have been looking for with regard to storage, conservation, reuse, and other water supply techniques. I wanted to point out a couple of areas here on place-based efforts. One of the things that we talked about a lot as part of the statewide strategy is that we can't do everything at the state level. Water planning must happen at the local level as well, and the state wants to engage very much with communities who have already identified challenges and are willing to start working on solutions. There's a request in here for some grant monies to get local communities to the table and with the capacity to participate as full partners in these discussions. I will also note, I think it's worth pausing here on Recommended Action 9C. This is an interstate-related recommended action. There are no quantified requests in this category yet, but we know there are some to come. The Governor's Task Force on the Columbia River Basin is hard at work in this area, and they are working through options and will have some requests to bring forward, I'm sure, in 2013. Water management and development is a huge area, and we've highlighted one piece in particular, the idea that the state may want to consider developing a water supply development program that is more robust and more in line with some of what our neighboring western states have already begun to do. In other states, I'm thinking particularly in Washington, the state has a more robust role at the table when it comes to developing water supply as an investor, as a funder, and as a full partner. And so we're working on legislative concepts that would bring those authorities more fully to the table in 2013. And healthy ecosystems, this is a, we're harkening back now to something that I mentioned earlier where Fish and Wildlife and Water Resources Department have partnered on a budget request to get a better grip on in-stream protections, and we'll bring those forward into 2013. Public health, obviously a very important piece, a huge job when it comes to the portfolio of Oregon Health Authority and Department of Environmental Quality. Important programs here that are already in place and continuing to move forward, but no new or additional funding requests for 2013 in this area. And finally, funding. This is the big one. We'll have funding requests in several different areas. One is the ability to continue planning, having these conversations, and engaging with other agencies and local communities in our water resource future. So that's the first one you see there, 13A. 13B is funding the core capacity of our natural resource agencies, and particularly water. There are a couple of ideas on the table for that in 2013 that you'll be seeing in more detail. And finally, 13C is the continuation of a grant program that communities have found to be very beneficial as they are pursuing water resource projects. They often lack funding in the area of feasibility studies. That's been a popular program, and we'd like to recapitalize that and move it forward into the future. So I know that's a lot in a short amount of time, but those are the highlights and areas that you're likely to see returning to you in the 2013 session. Mr. Chair, we're happy to take questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Vence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all of your work on this. It's quite the effort, and it's such a huge, challenging area to attack in this fashion. It seems to me, in looking at it, that my concerns raised a year ago and 2 years ago are still, I still have them. And I'm just going to mention them in the context of when you ask for the funding, I would really appreciate that you emphasize these concerns. Because those are the ones that are up there are fairly broad. There are really about three. The first is the document, the plan needs to be more forceful about protecting Oregon's water in the Clean Water Act implementation process. It's not really mentioned here. There's some remarks about the need to be aware of clean water and the impact it has on quantity, but there's no suggestion really that we aggressively look at this issue in the context of how we're going to continue to irrigate. And that is hugely important, and yet it's not really called out here. And to the extent that your department can protect the use of water out of stream, which is a huge part of what the department does, from the demand of the Clean Water Act, we're going to have to do it. Very challenging. Here's the second. I have the privilege of serving on the Forest State River Governance Committee. I just attended their meeting for 3 weeks ago in Boise, and I noticed that the other three states that are upstream from us, Washington, Idaho, Montana, are all aggressively asserting their claims to that water in the Columbia Basin. And they are going to be you can look at anything and see that every state is talking about more storage. This renegotiation of the Columbia River Treaty is difficult for Oregon because we're a state and not the federal government. But we have folks that participate at the federal level called senators and congressmen and women, and they need to be told again and again and again to get money for us to participate at that table. Because the flow of water out of Canada will dramatically impact the flow in the Columbia during the summer. And we need to be there. Absolutely need to be there. Last thing, the bias of the document is toward environment as opposed to out-of-stream use. And it's apparent when one reads it, and it's truly unfortunate. We don't need bias in the document. We're all in this together. The document needs to be as level, carefully directed as we can make it. And what it does, by the document, I mean the approach. So when I see comments about how much water is used out of stream and then no, the breakdown as reflected in the document is 92% in stream, 8% out of stream. So 92% of our water currently stays in stream. But once that statement is made, then every other statement talks about the 8% as though it were 100%. Can't do that. Now, the important part here isn't so much that unfortunate oversight or whatever it is. It's that there isn't enough time spent in determining whether or not that 8% is appropriate or not. There's allusions to it, but not or kind of sideways oblique references to it. But there has to be more discussion about the measure of the proper amount that we can take out. And that goes to water availability. And I couldn't help but notice on page 16 of the document, under permits, it says, in 1989, the Water Resource Commission directed the Water Resource Department to develop an allocation policy. I was there. I don't think I wasn't chairman. I think I was just a member in 89. In fact, I'm sure of it. And the water availability program was imprecise by design because we did not have enough information or data to do it right. And I sat at that table and I said, hey, this is going to instantly subject Oregon to the theory of misplaced concreteness, and here it is. Here it is. It's referenced as though it was the gospel. It's not. That tool, as it's referenced here, the resulting tool based on historical hydrologic record helps evaluate whether new surface water. Where is the reference to the fact that that tool is imprecise? Because that the imprecise nature of the tool or all of our devices needs to be appropriately reflected in this document. There should be a whole section on how we as a organization appropriately recalibrate, review, study the tools that we use. And so since I was there and helped write it, I'm here to tell everybody that tool is imprecise. And by design, because we hoped over the next 20 years it would get better. Here we are, 20 years. So actually a little more than that. So it's great to have this opportunity to remind all of us what we did all those years ago. And so those are my three points. And we've got the strategy now. And then, so the hope, my hope is that we'll be able to work with you and get the appropriate funding to protect Oregon. One last remark, and it goes back to protecting Oregon. This document should have a much higher level of fear in it, paranoia, like I enjoy over in Eastern Oregon. We all do. This document doesn't have it. And one of the reason is, and I've said it before, is that the folks that write it live in a swamp, the Willamette Valley. Okay, a swamp. And writing a document for folks that live in the desert, when you live in a swamp, very difficult. Right. And it's apparent that it doesn't reflect the degree of paranoia that my constituents live with every day. And Oregon needs that paranoia because everybody above us on the Columbia is going to take the water. And by the way, this document doesn't even reference under the 100 million number it uses as that the yield of water in Oregon. It doesn't even mention the Columbia, at least to the extent it doesn't. It arises outside of our boundaries. It should, because that river is pretty important to us. And so we should be looking at all flows of water into Oregon. I might mention the Snake also, since it's pretty important to my part of the world. Mm-hmm. But my goal is not to attack the document. My goal is to help you guys do a really good job with it. And so to the extent I can be of assistance, I offer it. And look forward to seeing whatever your legislative concepts are to move the protection of Oregon's water forward. And that's not much of a question, Mr. Chair. I thank you for your help.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chair, perhaps a modest response on a couple of the representative points. And I appreciate your comments, Representative Benson. Obviously, we've talked about these issues many times over the years. I did want to note a couple things, particularly the Columbia River Treaty, an area you identified as some place that the state of Oregon needed to be engaged in. That is an area over the past year particularly. We have asserted the state of Oregon's interests in a really significant way. One of the things that had concerned us over time as we began to start attending meetings of the group shaping the federal deliberations on the Columbia River Treaty is that there was no discussion of water supply relative to that activity. And over the past year, we've worked very diligently to see a task actually adopted in the federal work plan relative to the Columbia River Treaty, reviewing water supply opportunities here in the United States as a new outcome of those treaty negotiations. And indeed, both us and the state of Washington have now submitted potential numbers that we think could be utilized in terms of out-of-stream supply,
coming from Canada that are now part of the formal federal work plan. So we've asserted our interests pretty aggressively in the last year. You know, it's interesting because I think this document does identify the economic portion of water in the state in a way. It identifies potential actions that we can take as a state that we have not aggressively taken in the past. And one of those, again, that you all, we hope, get the opportunity to look at if it makes all the way through the process, is this proposal that Oregon consider a water supply development program where we can match up with some of the activities of our neighboring states in terms of developing more aggressively new supply. So we think some of those things are in the document. We would not assert that it's a perfect document by any means, but we do believe there's room in there to work relative to the issues that you've articulated, Representative, and we're very open to working with you to make sure that happens. Thank you.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering what kind of interaction you have with the Oregon Solutions team that's looking at the Columbia River water withdrawal.
Representative, thank you for that question. In some ways, almost too much. We are doing a lot of the staff work for that effort. So my staff is staffing several of the committee, the subcommittees that group has underway right now. We're intimately involved in that effort, and we believe some of the recommendations in this strategy will dovetail very well with some of the things we see coming out of that process.
Representative Thompson.
One of my concerns, and I think you allude to it here, but I don't think it's emphasized in the trailers with what Representative Bentz discussed, is I don't see enough emphasis here in strategies to develop additional water storage capacity regionally. I mean, the Columbia River is a huge resource, but the Columbia River doesn't do much for Ashland. It seems to me if we accept global warming as a threat, we need to talk seriously about the reduction in winter snowpack and what we're going to do to replace water stored as snow should we not have winter snows. And that, to me, begs the question of Western Oregon water development reservoir strategies to trap winter rain. I mean, we have areas in the Coast Range with over 200 inches of rainfall, most of which runs downhill into my backyard and floods part of it. But, you know, if we could hold back part of that, we'd improve the stream health during the summers when they're very, very low, as well as provide water that could be utilized in other ways. But I don't see any part of any strategy that says here are the basins that we might likely develop a water storage strategy and here's the kind of timelines we need to look at. And in my district, we've talked for years about the Valsetts Basin development, where there once was a reservoir, albeit not that huge, but there's a lot of potential there, not involving U.S. Forest Service land, which is an impossibility, to do something that it's just stagnating. And I think there are probably some other smaller reservoirs that might be expanded. There are other basins that might be developed, but I don't see any strategy to identify those and look at timelines for what we would have to do when in order to get how much water. We need more water available. I mean, we can do all kinds of things to measure groundwater and reallocate water rights, but we're just trading the same bottle of water. And it's true, I do live in a swamp, but I have no intention of letting Representative Bentz have one bottle of it. You know, what keeps us green, so we need to find more water for the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have to say that we agree fully that we need to, that an ultimate outcome of this activity needs to be that we specifically identify where we can go to develop new water supply. So what's laid out here is the framework for that and a proposal for the development of a water supply program in the state of Oregon. We've actually done, it doesn't show up in the document, but we've, part of the background work is we've actually identified every reservoir site that has ever been identified and studied in the state of Oregon. And we have that now as a part of the appendices material for this document. What we need to do then is we need to have actually a concerted and dedicated effort to move some of that forward. And so that's, again, if it makes it all the way through the process, our hope is that you will see a legislative concept articulating that for your consideration this next session.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, this reminds me of a question that I wanted to ask. I'm glad that Representative Kenny Geyer asked about your relationship with the...
Oregon Solutions.
And we're going to, you probably noticed on our agenda, we were going to have a draft 10-year energy plan discussion. We're out of time, but we won't be doing that this morning. But I do want to know if, because I know you got a lot on your plate and it's a different mission. However, have you been one of the stakeholders? Have you been part of drafting that plan since you're both here in the room? What triggers the question, of course, is for me the valuable Columbia, which has been highlighted now a couple of times. So I just wanted to know if that was part of your work.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, we have been cross-referencing and participating in each other's pieces. Department of Energy staff have been very closely integrated into our discussions and vice versa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional questions? In reference to Representative Thompson's question, and I'm glad that there was questions between Representative Benz's questions and my questions, because frankly, they just seem like simple questions now. I'm seeing under Goal 1 in the Southwest Quadrant, infrastructure under 7A and 7B. Brenda, I think I heard you reference in your presentation that those, most of the issues that are in that Southwest Quadrant are going to be issues for 2015. I would assume that that is predicated on the fact that there is a effort in 2013 under Goal 2 in the Southeast Quadrant under 10E, and that that is a necessary precursor to the discussions in on 7A and B. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, that's one piece of it, but as well, the infrastructure that we have in our everyday operations, from water utilities to irrigation canals and pipes, those sorts of efforts are underway today and continue, and that's more focused on the need for maintenance and upgrade and expansion of systems, and that a lot of that work is taking place already at the local level and largely with federal dollars at this point. So that much of the infrastructure that we refer to there is our programs that are large revolving loan funds and things that are underway today that don't necessarily have a new request or new type of request coming forward in 2013.
Got it. So just so I'm clear, as Director Ward, as you mentioned, there are going to be concepts coming forward in 2013 to deal with some of the issues that Representative Thompson brought up regarding how we begin to consider the effects of changes in runoff and water supply and snow melt and the way that we manage that in this state. What kinds of things are we looking for in 2013?
So, Mr. Chair, again, I think kind of the centerpiece of that discussion would be the question as to whether Oregon should implement a water supply development program for our state. So that would be a program that with speaking conceptually, where bond funds could be set aside to invest with local communities to identify and implement some water supply solutions. One recent example of that is the state's investment, ad hoc investment in the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project. So are there similar opportunities in other parts of the state where we can move supply development solutions forward in partnership with local communities that the state can invest in and help make happen? One of the things that we found is that particularly on the feasibility end, local communities don't have the resources to do some of the upfront feasibility work to get the wheels under these kind of programs. And so that's the kind of thing where we see a strategic investment by the state through the use of some bond funds, perhaps, could move things forward. That's one example that we would where we hope you will get a chance to look at a proposal of that nature.
Great, thank you. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very
much.
Thank you. Very informative. Okay, let's go back up to the top and call forward Margie Hoffman for an update on the draft 10-year energy action plan.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me today. My name is Margie Hoffman. I'm the governor's energy policy advisor, and I'm here to give you an update on the governor's draft 10-year energy action plan. As many of you are aware, and I testified earlier this year, there was a six-month task force that was convened to look at what we should do in terms of setting a long-term strategy for energy policy in the state of Oregon for the next 10 years. That task force met and came out with 198 policy recommendations that were then distilled into a draft energy action plan that was released on June 5th of this year for public comment. In the 60 days that we had that open for public comment, we received 1,200 comments from constituents all throughout the state of Oregon on all different aspects of the plan. We also did three public hearings, one in Klamath Falls, one in Bend, and one in Gresham, which were pretty well attended. We had about 50 to 75 people at each of those public hearings to give us feedback on components of the plan. We have finished we're about finished reviewing the comments, and those will be posted on the Oregon Department of Energy's website so everybody can see the public comments that we received on the component pieces of the plan, and we will release a final plan later this year. We look forward to working with members of this committee and members of the Senate on component legislation that we'll need to push through next session in order to move forward on the first steps of the draft 10-year energy plan. So that is where we are right now. I'm happy to take any questions that you have on policy pieces, things that we've included, things that we've not included.
Thank you. I think maybe before we get into questions, could you just walk us through a brief overview of the outline of what are the major bullets and categories? I think, I think all of us have had a chance to see the draft plan. I'm not sure we've had a chance to talk with you since May, and we've had that plan come out since then. So perhaps you could just give us a quick overview for the record.
Absolutely. So in the plan, we focus on three core areas. The first core area that we focus on is maximizing energy efficiency and conservation. As consumer demand for energy grows in the state of Oregon, we hope that it will grow. We want to make sure that we are meeting that new demand in a least cost manner so that we can continue to maintain competitive energy prices in the Pacific Northwest. We enjoy very low cost of energy right now, and we want to make sure that we continue to do that. So we're taking a hard look at the current regulatory framework that we have for energy efficiency and the delivery mechanisms that we have to support energy efficiency and conservation in the state of Oregon. One of the things that we talk about in the 10-year energy plan, for example, is a continuation of the Cool Schools program. We want to move forward with a state building innovation lab that will reduce energy consumption in state-owned buildings by 20% over the next 10 years. We've identified up to 4 million retrofittable square feet of commercial office space. The benefit, again, to reducing our utility bills is not only that the state saves money, but that we can continue to invest and grow our economy and create local jobs. With the Cool Schools program, the state put in $175,000 of investment, and from that, we've leveraged $21 million in economic activity. Thank you, Representative Bailey and members of this committee, for sponsoring that legislation last legislative session. We want to continue to build on that. And one school district in particular is now saving over $90,000 a year on their utility bill, and that's the difference between keeping a teacher and having to let a teacher go. So we want to continue to pursue what we can, energy efficiency and conservation projects for all state-owned infrastructure so that we can continue to create more dollars that we can roll into programs. In addition to maximizing energy efficiency, that's the first goal. Goal number two is cleaning up or continuing to build out a clean energy infrastructure. We hear a lot from constituents throughout the state that we need more predictability and certainty in siting. This is probably the piece of the plan where we have the most consensus to date. We need more predictability and certainty from the side of developers. developers who are moving into the state and want to develop energy projects here. We need more predictability and certainty on the side of natural resources protection so that we can make sure that we can maintain habitat for some critically important species in the state. And the third goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector through converting fleets and offering more consumer choice for the types of vehicles that they drive and the types of fuels that they put into those vehicles. So those are the three main components of the plan that we put forward. Those are the three goals of the plan that we put forward. And on pages 39 and 40 of the plan, there's a grid that goes through all of the different policy items that we outlined in the plan and whether those policy items require statutory authorization, whether they require administrative action or executive action.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Questions from this committee? Representative.
Yeah, I just was wondering if you could give us I know it could be long, but a brief overview of the expected outcomes for 2013.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're really what I just said. Sorry, Chair Bailey, Representative Boone. We are working with people on building out, taking a hard look at energy efficiency right now. So working with people at Clean Energy Works Oregon and the Energy Trust of Oregon, the investor-owned utilities. We'll be meeting with the publicly owned utilities as well to figure out how are we investing in energy efficiency right now? Can we do better? Where should we do better? Are there additional market opportunities that we should be capturing? Are there additional market barriers that we should be removing in order to increase the amount of money that's invested in energy efficiency? Number two is there are two sets of siting changes. One are short-term changes that deal with the Energy Facility Siting Council. So one of those recommended changes is creating a strong project officer model. So when a developer comes into the state of Oregon, they have one-stop shopping for all of the different component pieces and all of the different agencies that they need to that they need to negotiate with in the siting process. So those are some of the shorter-term fixes. The longer-term fix is creating a landscape-level plan that will look at all of the available energy resources that we can harvest in the state and all of the critical habitat that we need to protect and the species for which we need to mitigate and overlay those resources so that developers can come in and they can see if they want to develop a project in a specific area of the state, what types of species or what types of mitigation will they have to go through in order to get their permit, and then the creation of a mitigation bank, which would allow natural resources agencies to aggregate funds and invest those funds to best protect habitat that may or may not be directly linked with the project. And then in the transportation section, we talk about fleet conversion. And fleet conversion, like most things, you have to come up with the upfront cost of capital. So we're looking at different ways that we can help fund conversion of fleets, both the installation of the infrastructure and the conversion of the vehicles themselves. Long-term operations of some alternative vehicles are less expensive than the vehicles that we're operating right now. And in addition to converting the fleets, when you build out that infrastructure, then consumers will have more choices about the types of vehicles that they can purchase, and they'll have the infrastructure in place to support them utilizing that vehicle.
Just a quick follow-up.
Absolutely.
You said something on the second point that reminded me of something from the Solar Siting Task Force. One of the things that's become an issue is the potential, species of concern, that one. And there are lots of them, or could be lots of them, and they might take quite a bit of time to analyze. And that time frame is short because of the tax incentives that the federal government's offering. So could you talk a little bit about that and how we could get past that bump?
Yeah, Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Boone, first I want to thank you for chairing the Solar Siting Work Group. I think that the last two conversations that we've had have been incredibly productive in highlighting areas of the siting statute that we need to clean up. I think that the group has made a lot of headway in figuring out how we can work around both the jurisdictional threshold and also the species of concern issue. So I see that solar siting piece not only coming up with short-term policy recommendations for ways that we could make the Energy Facility Siting Council process more predictable and more certain for developers, but also That will provide us with critical information and data that we'll need for the solar component of landscape level planning as well. So I think that group will come up with policy recommendations that we can move forward on next legislative session. And thank you for chairing that. I really appreciate it.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of need to know if the low carbon fuel standard is a part of the plan. Is it a part of the plan?
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, the low carbon fuel standard was included in the draft. In the draft 10-year energy action plan, we received a lot of comments on the low carbon fuel standard. So we'll be, you know, taking those comments into consideration and releasing the final plan later this year.
Follow up. So a decision apparently hasn't yet been made whether the governor is going to support the standard. Is that the proper, is that where you are on that now?
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, we do support the standard. That's why we included it in the draft 10-year energy action plan. The reason that we support it is that gasoline prices are high right now. And we just had, you know, we have high gas prices because an oil refinery caught on fire and because of the, you know, not knowing how Hurricane Isaac will impact domestic fuel prices. Right now, what we want to do is make sure that we diversify our fuel sources so that, again, we can keep down the cost of fuel to consumers. I think at the same time, we need to pay attention to the impact of the low carbon fuel standard to consume, the cost of implementing the low carbon fuel standard to consumers, and figure out how we can diversify our fuel supply so that we can keep fuel prices in the Pacific Northwest lower. At the same time, you know, building out the infrastructure and figuring out, again, where does that upfront cost of capital come from? How are we going to do that, and in what time frame?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. The concern I have is this, about many of the thoughts that are in the plan, and that is that the underlying assumption is that all carbon is bad. And there doesn't seem to be a measure, then, of how bad carbon is. Once that assumption has been made, then there's a movement toward anything to reduce carbon, again, without reference to the cost, one on the one hand, of reducing carbon, and then on the other, the benefit that's going to be achieved by such reduction. It would help me enormously, and I'm sure the rest of us, in making our decisions on whatever is proposed, if the benefit that's to be achieved by that which this plan aspires is given to us. And so otherwise we can't weigh and balance alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if the low carbon fuel standard is going to cost X to implement, what's the benefit and how do we measure it? That second step is missing. Instead, what we are given is just this assumption, all carbon is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So without a measure, can't weigh and balance. Did you understand that concept? It's really important because it's not in here, and it needs to be. There's a reference to cost-benefit, but not in the sense that I'm suggesting it be presented to us.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate it. And in the beginning of the plan, carbon reduction is a component of why the governor wanted to move forward with the 10-year energy action plan. The other components are continuing to provide stable, reliable energy, to continue to keep our energy prices low, so that, again, as demand grows, we're meeting that in a least cost way. To your point, one of the task force recommendations was to commission a study to look at the cost effectiveness of a lot of the different measures that we talked about in the draft 10-year energy action plan. That study will be released and provided to legislators so that you can look at how cost effective each of the measures are, independent of one another and collectively as a whole. So you should get a copy of that here in the next couple of weeks.
Let me,
please.
Thank you. Okay, I'm fearful that analysis is not going to focus on the point I'm making, and that is we need a measure of the benefit. If we're going to reduce carbon by X, how are we going to measure that benefit and compare it to other things we might do to achieve the same result?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what I'm going to see when I see your report. But, and I have this strange deja vu sense that we've had this conversation before, but I really do want to see the measure of the good.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you for your comments, and I look forward to working with you on that.
Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just add to that, as you look at the benefits, part of it is carbon reduction. Part of it is the potential for local economic development in replacing these fuels. Part of it is projections of if we continue our reliance on fuel sources that come in from out of state, and if those all of a sudden spike, where does that leave us compared to if we diversify? So in addition to the reduction of carbon, there are a number of different potential benefits, and it would be great to see that analysis.
Mm-hmm. Richard Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Welcome back.
Sorry I'm late.
No, you're fine.
Construction traffic. Good jobs.
Yeah. 1,200 folks commented. Were you getting some feedback that they might disagree with the assumption that this plan will, and it's a great goal, that this plan will lower gas prices? Bless you.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of specific comments that we got. A lot of the comments were general comments in support of diversifying the fuel supply so that we're not subject to the volatility of a single market or a couple of markets, but that consumers have choices so that as a market fluctuates, they can make other decisions about how they want to power their vehicles. But again, it's critically important that we look at the infrastructure that we have to support converting from where we are now to where we need to go, how we build out that infrastructure, where the money to build out that infrastructure comes from. And there are a lot of creative ideas that have been brought forward about how we would do that. So most of what we received are general comments about the need to diversify the fuel supply and the support of figuring out how to do that.
My fear is focus on transportation sector. Well, first of all, I too have some problems with that supposition that that's where we start getting at carbon. But that focus has some great goals. But I fear that we're going not to go with lower prices. There may be all kinds of infrastructure and stabilization benefits that you refer to. I don't believe, and the preliminary report doesn't convince me, I don't believe we're going to lower prices with this strategy. I believe there's a high likelihood we'll do just the opposite, and I think we need to have that discussion before we move ahead with any kind of plan like this. And I look forward to a little more conversation about that. I also wanted to ask you about the legislative package, you called it, I think, the components that you're going to need for this to go forward. Are we going to have that as a, it's probably an unfair question because you're working on it right now, but are we going to have that as a package, or are we going to see that sort of piecemeal as you work through it?
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, that's a great question. We will release, when we release the final plan, that will give people a roadmap of what we will be asking of the legislature, partnering with the legislature to work on. It depends on which policy you're talking about. Again, siting is where we have the most consensus and where we have the clearest picture about where we need to go, where we're headed. Other areas like maximizing energy efficiency are very long, very complicated conversations. So I can't tell you at this point in time. I can tell you that we will bring forward a legislative concept that we will be working on probably throughout session. But we will release, when we release the final plan later this year, you'll get a list of bills that we will be partnering with the legislature to work on.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could just continue for a moment. Well, and please, if you need a note to some other, please ask any of us, because we'd be glad to assist with that. You got three components, and I want to ask you, sort of with Representative Bentz, we focused on the fact that the low-carbon fuel standard's in here.
Mm-hmm.
How would you characterize it? Of the three points, which I think are all very helpful to understand the plan, what's the percentage? What's the importance of low-carbon fuel in the whole plan? Is it equally, you know, 33, 33, 33, or is it 50 the rest? How big is it in the plan, in your view?
Representative Bailey, Representative Gilliam, the goal is to convert 20% of large fleets over the course of the next 10 years, again, to build out that infrastructure, to diversify consumer choice, to make sure that as, you know, gas prices are, they continue to rise. The question is, at what rate? In terms of a percentage breakdown, I think that is, excuse me, that is a way that we can get to where we want to go in terms of diversifying vehicles that are on the market and people's ability to drive those vehicles outside of a 10-block radius of their house. So that is one of the things that we'll be looking at with legislators and with stakeholders is, again, how do we achieve that benchmark over the course of the next decade? And that is a policy mechanism that could get us there.
I have to say, I am very happy that the energy efficiency portions are totally uncontroversial, apparently, on this panel. Any additional...
Simple, really.
Yeah, they're technical fixes, really. Any additional questions, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Margie, you alluded to the potential for economic development, and it's an area that I'm very concerned about because I think our state is in the process of losing the battle in economic development relative to some of our neighbors. I'm also concerned about the potential for increased costs under this plan, and I'm wondering if the final plan will detail the potential upside and downside of increased energy costs as a whole, and particularly how they may impact economic development. Now, as you said, building out a clean energy structure, I think, holds a great potential. But I also think that that sends us down a path that clearly defines one set of industries that we may or may not gain, likely will. And I think there is a great potential for us to forego the development of other industries in that process. I'm wondering if the plan is at all going to entertain any kind of discussion about those kinds of trade-offs, one industry for potentially some others.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Witt, thank you for your question. Again, the intent of this plan and the reason that we laid out the goals the way in which we did is because we want to keep the cost of energy and the cost of fuel low in Oregon. We are on the top of Forbes' list of manufacturing states. We want to continue to grow that base and continue to be an attractive place for people to come and locate their businesses. Energy efficiency is the cheapest way to meet in increasing consumer demand for energy in the state of Oregon. So as that consumer demand grows, again, we want to make sure that we're meeting that in a least cost way. I think it's also incredibly important on the electricity side, the energy generation side, because of policies that were put in place have been able to diversify how we are meeting consumer demand for electricity, and again, not subjecting ourselves to the volatility of a single market or a couple of markets, but that as volatile fuel sources rise and fall, we also have wind, which we don't pay anything for wind for the fuel source. We don't pay anything for the power of the sun. So we need to continue to diversify those resources. The role of natural gas is critically important in backing up variable resources, and also the role of the hydro system is incredibly important in backing those diversified resources. So the whole intent of the plan is to look at how we create stable, reliable energy, what opportunities we have to localize that energy, and also how we can maintain our competitiveness as we compete for jobs in a really tough economy.
Mr. Chairman.
Paul?
Margie, not to be argumentative, and I bless your efforts at the development of solar energy, but as a member of this committee, I sat here in utter shock last session when we had no ability to move forward in the development of solar energy farms. And I can tell you that we've gotten ourselves to a place in this state where when we forgo the opportunity to develop solar energy, it has significant cost to the rest of our economy. And we have lost opportunities far beyond the immediate loss of that solar energy farm development in terms of economic development, energy development, and we have a very, very long ways to go before we're ever able, I believe, to develop these resources that we all want to develop. I commend Representative Boone and others for their efforts to try and bring these issues to resolution. But I, for one, am convinced that we're getting ourselves to a place where it's just say no first in the state of Oregon. And I'm also convinced that much of this plan holds great potential for increasing the costs of energy in rural Oregon, where we all already pay a premium for our energy costs. And should this plan increase costs further, I asked the question the last session of legislative days about this plan, whether we would use the safety valve that allows us, if there are increased costs, to set this plan aside. What I was told, quote unquote, there were no guarantees. That leaves me very little confidence that this is a plan that's intended to best serve the interests of many Oregonians.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Witt, thank you for your comment. I think building consumer protection mechanisms into everything we do is critically important. There is a consumer protection mechanism in the renewable portfolio standard so that the intent of that is not to diversify resources no matter the cost. It's to diversify resources, again, to protect consumers and also make sure that if the cost of doing that is expensive, that people don't have to meet the standard. So I think I absolutely agree with you. I think that's an incredibly important component to anything that we do and move forward on. And in terms of siting, I absolutely agree with you. More predictability and more certainty, and that's what we're hearing from everyone. So I think that's the place, again, where we have the most consensus.
Thank you.
Representative Kinnegar.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a point of clarification, just out of memory, because I didn't realize we'd be talking so much about the clean fuels standard. Is the 5% cap at which point you could suspend the program permissive, or is that mandated? As I recall, it's a 5% cap. If expenses go up over 5%, then the program is suspended.
Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Kinnegar, I want to see if... I will follow up with you.
He said he's happy to answer, I think.
Palmer, you want to come up?
Thank you.
I think she's looking at Ted.
Ted, come on up.
For the record, Palmer Mason with the Department of Environmental Quality. Representative Kinnegar, your question, it is actually permissive in that we have to do an evaluation that there is a 5% differential between the cost at the pump in Oregon versus the neighboring states, and then we would take action at that point.
Thanks, Palmer.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Any further questions from the committee?
I have one.
Of course you do.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. You said you absolutely agree with my colleague. I want to make sure that you absolutely agree with Representative Witt on the point that this is going to cost rural Oregon a lot more money in energy costs. So you don't absolutely agree with him on that point.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, I should clarify. I absolutely agree with him that we need to build consumer protection mechanisms into everything that we do. A lot of rural Oregon gets their energy off of the Bonneville system. They get their energy efficiency dollars and their electricity off of the Bonneville system, and that's a huge benefit to the state of Oregon.
Thank you for your testimony. I have to say, colleagues, that... Oh, we have...
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Margie, I appreciate that comment very much, and I would offer myself as someone who would be willing to help bring us to that end. This is critical, absolutely critical, so thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. I have to comment, colleagues, that I enjoyed driving down to this committee meeting today on a biofuel that cost me about 50 cents less a gallon than diesel at the pump, and my hope that everybody could enjoy those kinds of cost savings, because frankly, when I'm going back and forth, it sure saves me a lot of money every month. So thanks for trying to save costs for Oregonians.
Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it.
All right. We're going to move on. Representative Boone, are you ready with your update? Nice dovetail here.
You want me to go down there?
Please, if you're willing.
But I'm concerned about your cholesterol.
You're going to have to.
And colleagues, we're going to have an update on the solar siting work group.
Am I allowed to bring my sidearm to the table here? My colleague here, our co-chair, said he's going to get me.
Well, we don't know. Might hurt us.
For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I'm reporting on the solar siting work group that we've been holding a couple of meetings in the interim on this issue. And just a little editorial comment on it, and I wanted to say that Representative Witt brought it up in that sense that people have been trying very hard to find other resources, renewable energy resources, and that's one of the, that's obviously the reason for this. Some developers came to us in this committee and presented what they would like to do to meet that need and help us meet our RPS requirements through solar energy, which I have to say I'm very enthusiastic about, because believe it or not, we at the coast even have sun, and this week it's been very nice down there. I'm here, it's there. I'll be going back this afternoon, and I hope it sticks around. The only caveat there is we're in a very high fire danger season right now, so some of the work we've been trying to do on our place, we cannot do. Our bulldozer is stuck in the woods, and we have to remove a track, and we cannot use the torch with good faith this week. So maybe if you wouldn't mind and you come to the beach, pray for a little rain at night, and then we can get our work done. So with that said, and Beth did a great job of staffing this task force and has very graciously provided me with some of the updates, too. I don't know if you want me to read off the list of the members of it, but it's a diversified group. There are legislators, there are people from the industry, there's advocacy groups, Forum Bureau, IBEW, electric people, electrifying people, conservation people, construction trades, the solar energy industries, Nature Conservancy, Governor's Office, and several agencies of the state, Ag and DLCD, Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Energy. So it was a well-rounded group. We have met in July, and at the meeting, the group discussed the current laws and rules governing solar siting on farmland and agreed to break into two subgroups, one to address the wildlife standard and the second, a jurisdictional subgroup to address the question of when a project falls under county review and when it falls under the review of the Energy Facility Siting Council. And both subgroups then subsequently met on August 30th and had a much more detailed discussion of their respective topics. And they've made assignments to some of their members, and after those assignments are complete, they may meet again or they may be ready to send some recommendations back to the full group based on the input from all of those subgroup members. Excuse me. There aren't any final recommendations to report at this time, but they should be completing their work over the next month to 6 weeks, and we'll report in plenty of time for our December meeting to the committee. And I did mention one of those issues, and it was the species of concern issue, and how that may fall, and how the developer is concerned that the time it will take, and it could be up to 50 species, the time it would take to analyze and assess each of those species and get that information and data back to the developer in time to finish a report that will address those. They're racing the clock to get their tax credit from the federal government, which ends, I think, in between 3 and 4 years. So that time, sorry?
Isn't it 2015?
2015, yeah, that's 3 years. And so the time crunch does not appear to be enough time to address all the potential, because it's not a defined thing. And then Margie talked about certainty and in the development of these things, and that's one of the issues. It's very frustrating. And if I may sink into the similar situation in the ocean energy sector, they're finding the same thing. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, and people are looking at, they're scrambling to find a place to land, and it's just not a real friendly atmosphere out there at this point. The frustration piece of it is they then come to us, in the legislative members, and say, hey, I thought you wanted to develop more, you know, clean energy sources, and that's what we're doing here. Now, it's not just to Oregon. It's all over the world. It's happening. And so as people try to balance the needs of assessing conservation needs, environmental needs, economic needs, and energy needs, which unless people are willing to say we're going to use less energy, it's going to be an issue. And so I really like the idea of us creating a way that will be, and everybody says one-stop shopping, but you all know what I mean, a more simplified and streamlined permitting process to this end, and which the end is get more energy, get cleaner energy, fulfill our RPS needs. And I loved hearing, I was in California last week, and I was paying $4.65 a gallon for gas, and that was a little shocking, and that was just for regular. But there was a place we went, and the premier parking place had a electric plug-in, and it was, if you had the car that went here, people were talking about it. It was kind of a new thing, and this was in Eureka, so not like San Francisco or anything, but people were talking about that and saying, yeah, I last visited a gas pump in, what, May? I mean, there were things like that. It was, these things are coming down the pike. They're not going to be for everybody. Rural Oregon is going to be challenged to meet the same kind of end, but I hope that we can get there, and there are examples of successful, and I know I've gone far afield of the solar thing right now, but I just want to say there are other areas, other sectors of clean energy that are being successful, and they're not all in the U.S., and they are transferable to our area, and those people who developed there are very interested in coming here and sharing the wealth. So it's possible. I look forward to it. The solar siting work group hopefully can get to where they need to be, and we'll have a really good report for you in December. And I'm happy to answer questions from everybody except Co-Chair Gilliam. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Krieger.
Debbie, you and I saw in the environmental movement on forestry, commercial fish, every time they try to do something, there's a challenge and it stops it. Are these solar farms going to be a permitted use under land use? Are they going to get changes there? Or under the present system, a guy from New York could challenge that placement and get it tied up in court for years.
That's true.
And so here again,
that's a whole nother can of worms.
That's another can of worms, but we're experiencing it in the counties. You know, the 18 timber-dependent counties. Mm-hmm. My county's basically bankrupt. Others are coming in the next couple of years, and it's all because the environmental for-profit industry is suing to stop anything and everything. And until our federal legislators change the Endangered Species Act, we are not going to get out of this conundrum that we're in. It's just going to continue. And everyone here on this committee, I know, wants to protect those environments and sensitive places. We have the knowledge, the technology to do it, but that doesn't seem to be enough to satisfy certain people.
Well, to that note, and Northern California is different than Southern California, but that's a whole other discussion. But I did see a small solar farm there. I can't tell you exactly where it was. It was between Eureka and San Francisco, which was my driving route during the daylight hours. It appeared to be outside a smallish town. I wasn't paying attention to the signs, but it looked like that was their source of energy, and it was very close to a lot of vineyards. So I'm guessing there was a combination there in the wine country to power their needs with solar. And it was what we're looking at here. And I imagine that in that area, it's very environmentally sensitive in that area. You've got the redwoods, a lot of water issues there. The water issues in California are different than ours, but they have some very innovative ways of dealing with that, and that's a whole other issue. But maybe appropriate for this committee at some point in the future. But that was they're about 3-4 feet off the ground type thing. And in an area very close to where they were growing grapes. So I'm guessing that was allowable by some land. They have pretty strong land use laws down there, too. What we're talking about in our solar siting group here is siting on land that's not commonly used for farming. And I don't know. And to answer your question, Wayne, I don't know. That's real possible. Anybody can sue anybody for anything. And they don't have to be here from here to do it. So maybe it's a judiciary committee question.
Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you may have touched on what I was going to ask about. I know there's the species of concern issue. There is the how big can solar farms be. I was just going to ask a little bit about the jurisdictional, which I think Representative Krieger started alluding to, just what are the federal, state, local issues that you're trying to work through, if you could touch upon them. But you actually just did with that last question. But I just want to state for the record, I'm very supportive of expanding our solar, and I thank you and the committee for working hard on this, and I hope we have some very solid legislation going forward that helps this industry meet the needs of the low carbon fuel standards and all the economic development, all the goals that we've been talking about, low carbon.
So I do too, and I think when I hear solar industry is a little bit newer to me, but in dealing with the developers and those who would develop in ocean energy and tidal energy, and you know, both north and south of us are working hard on that, and everybody's watching Oregon to see what we do. Right now, we're the developers. A need certainty; they need to know what they're up against. They're very happy to meet the parameters of the law. They're happy to get a tax credit. It doesn't have to last forever. They don't think it should. They think you should give a tax credit to help people out at the beginning of things. And I don't want to get into that discussion of trading, selling, and all that, but because I have my own personal views of that. But talking to these people who want to come here and help develop this industry, and I'm very sensitive to it because at the coast, and I know you've heard me go off on the emergency preparedness stuff, but we are going to be cut off from the regular grid on the coast for a period of time. And I'm not talking weeks or months, I'm talking years. And so it's very important for us on the coast, at least, to get some sort of energy source that we can restore our activities, our economy, etc., until things get back. And you know what? Once you build these things, the fuel is free. So, and it's clean, and it's going to help us do all these other things. It's going to create the jobs. It's got all the right stuff going for it. But they need that, and the one particular company who wanted to develop in Oregon and ended up leaving because they couldn't get certainty on even their testing vehicle, which is about as big as a washing machine, to sit in the water for a couple of years and collect some data on movement of the water. So they've gone to California, and they're just going gangbusters down there. So California's moving forward on it. They have just as strong of these things, but they're working on ways to, you know, how can we help you get to yes? And talking to people and saying, what do you, you know, Representative Kenny Guy, or your device that you, and we've got people here in Oregon, in South Salem, who've developed something to go offshore. They've kept their day jobs, though, just in case. And I think we've heard from them here. But they need the certainty. They need to know what's it going to take for them to get their device, you know, in this case, in the water, producing power to the grid, and then, you know, moving along and meeting the needs of this state to provide energy. And that's important for us to pay very close attention to, because if we keep on just twiddling our thumbs or waiting and say, what if, they're going to go somewhere else. So we watch what's happening. I work in several other groups who are working around this country, mostly in the Northwest, I have to say. And even in Hawaii, they're doing things. I mean, that is like the most environmentally sensitive and sensible place in the world, it seems, for states. And they're going forward with projects that will provide power. They can stand alone. They have to. We're not running a wire over there. They're doing all kinds of things, and they're also protecting their people, their needs, and they're growing like gangbusters, too. So it's possible. We just need to do it.
Great. Thank you. Representative Witt, we're going to need to move on after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Boone, Debbie, I can't help but conclude that not only was the coast cut off from the grid, but they were cut off from the hearings on the draft energy plan. But in any event, I'm curious whether the electric charging station that you observed in Northern California had any cost to the consumer who pulled up and recharged his or her vehicle?
I asked that question. Co-chairs, Representative Witt, I asked that question of the locals who were with us, and they weren't sure, but they think there was. They said somebody has to pay for the electricity. In that particular case, it was a building that housed several businesses that were trying to, and it was on their waterfront. They're trying to promote a whole new thing. They're doing kind of what we're doing up in Astoria, too. But they said they think that the port picks that up, and it's an incentive for their employees to drive these cars, and so they're picking it. Somebody's got to pay the electricity.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose for my question was to see if other states handle this differently. I'm very concerned that there's a disconnect between our energy policy and our transportation policy in this state. And I continually hear about the problems that ODOT and others are experiencing because there isn't adequate revenue being derived from your typical fuels taxes. And I just think that we have to find a way to start deriving revenue from the electrons that we're providing into people's vehicles as they recharge, and I'm happy to see that at least other states have envisioned possibly a way of achieving some kind of fairness between our typical fuels and our new fuels.
I think we've had that discussion through the Road User Task Force and a couple of other avenues. I think that's an excellent issue to bring up, and one that I think we're going to need to confront as a body. So
thank
I appreciate
you,
you bringing
Chairman.
That up.
Thank you.
If you'll permit me one more statement on this, I know we want to keep moving.
Please.
Representative Witt said something in the previous section on the so-called energy plan that I echo, and I just have to say this because I think you used the word astounded that we're still doing this. So I don't want to go backwards because I think this committee knows how frustrated I am that we are still doing this. So be sure, Beth and Debbie, that I appreciate what you're doing on this, and I want us to move forward, and I think we will. I don't care who has the gavel. I think we all want to do this before the next session. This needs to happen, and in my view, any
practical, sensible plan for energy in this state 10 years forward, 20 years forward, should include not only this particular project, but this subject. And if I'm just repeating Representative Witt, I'm fine with that, because I think he said it very well.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on what Representative Witt said, too, and asked his I remembered something when he was talking. They have fast, medium, and slow charge. So it's kind of like driving in France. If you want to get somewhere fast, you pay a higher fee on that road to go faster. If you want to go free, you go up through the hills. So the lowest charge cost is the overnight or many hours. The fast they have, like you can get 100 miles worth of movement for 20 minutes, and it costs the highest amount.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, colleagues. Thank you, Representative, for chairing this work group. We're very grateful for your efforts. Okay, we're going to move on to on-site septic system program, rulemaking on time of transfer inspections. Don't all leave at once. And yeah,
you pulled the plug on
him. Yeah, exactly. Well, welcome. Yes, help me pronounce your name.
Co-Chair Bailey, Mike Kaczynski.
Kaczynski?
Yes.
Mike Kaczynski and Palmer Mason. Please, gentlemen, don't let the exodus behind you in any way.
I thought it was us.
discourage you from proceeding.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me Mike Kaczynski. He is the manager of our on-site septic tank systems, our statewide program at DEQ. And we've been asked to talk about a proposed rule the department is looking at. Mike will provide more details, but in a thumbnail sketch of that rule is it's a proposed rule to require time of transfer inspections for on-site systems in our mid-coast counties of Oregon. So Mike's here to provide more information, and we'll take any questions.
At least on that one. All right.
And Mike reminded me, we do have maps for the committee, which I will pass out.
Good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mike Kaczynski, manager of the on-site septic system program at the Department of Environmental Quality. DEQ's on-site program is responsible for regulating the siting, design, installation, and ongoing operation and maintenance of septic systems to protect public health and prevent pollution in surface and groundwater. DEQ manages the on-site program in 12 counties directly, and 24 counties manage the program under contract with DEQ. The first page of the map shows that distribution of counties in DEQ. And the back part of that map shows the coastal zone management area, which I'll be talking about. As Palmer was saying, I'm here to provide some information on a rulemaking that DEQ is currently undertaking and answer any questions that you may have about it. This rulemaking would require septic systems to be inspected at the time of property transfer for properties located in Oregon's coastal area. To keep this brief, I'm going to focus my comments on answering three questions. One, why are we doing this? Two, why are we doing this now? And number three, why the requirement is only being imposed in the coastal area. Time of transfer inspections have been a topic of discussion in Oregon for a number of years, in large part due to requirements established in the Federal Coastal Zone Act reauthorization amendments of 1990, and I'll be referring to that as CESARA. So CESARA requires coastal states with approved coastal zone management programs to address non-point pollution impacting or threatening coastal waters. And states must submit coastal non-point pollution control programs for approval to both EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. States must have an approved plan in order to receive federal funding for non-point source pollution control programs. And in recent years, Oregon has been receiving close to $2 million per year from EPA for its non-point pollution program. About half of that grant supports technical assistance staff at DEQ, and then half is passed on through to local groups for water quality improvement projects. So to be approved, a state's program must include policies and systems to operate and maintain on-site systems so as to prevent surface water discharge and reduce pollutant loadings to groundwater. That includes inspection at regular time intervals and repair or replacement of faulty systems. And this is an important aspect of on-site management. A variety of studies from around the country, including a 2009 study in the McKinsey River Basin here in Oregon, have found that 10 to 30% of on-site systems are not functioning properly, and that could result in people being exposed to raw sewage and could cause pollution of surface and groundwater. A number of states have addressed the CESARA management measure by requiring that on-site systems be inspected at the time of property transfer. The time of transfer inspections have been shown to be an effective tool for identifying and addressing failing systems to ensure the protection of public health and environment. So, for example, after 3 years of a time of transfer program in the Barry Eaton District Health Department in Michigan, they found that 26% of the systems that were inspected were in need of some type of maintenance, repair, or replacement. And in their three-year report, the health department stated that the time of transfer program has served as the single most effective tool that they have in identifying and correcting public health environmental hazards. The time of transfer inspections came up in settlement negotiations for litigation filed in 2009 between the Northwest Environmental Advocates and EPA and NOAA. It was in regards to the approval of DEQ's Coastal Nonpoint Pollution Control Program. And for a number of years, EPA and NOAA have been conditionally approving DEQ's program and requiring DEQ to address a number of deficiencies, including the on-site septic system management measure that I previously mentioned. This settlement agreement between the Northwest Environmental Advocates and the federal agencies required EPA to discontinue grant funding to DEQ, which was, again, close to $2 million per year, if DEQ does not meet the terms of the settlement agreement. During those settlement negotiations, DEQ and the litigants discussed various ways to address this issue, including requiring regular inspections of all systems, such as once every 3 to 5 years. However, after reviewing approaches used in other states, DEQ felt that time of transfer inspections would be the best approach, and the litigants agreed to this. So that settlement agreement stipulates that DEQ must have that program in place by March of 2013. So that's the reason we are doing this rulemaking now, and also the reason we would require time of transfer inspections only in the coastal area. DEQ does have authority to require inspections of septic systems under ORS 454.615, which gives DEQ authority to prescribe minimum requirements for the operation and maintenance of septic systems. And although statewide implementation of the time of transfer inspection requirement was recommended by our 2009 on-site advisory committee, DEQ did not elect to implement the time of transfer requirement statewide at this time, and we currently do not have plans to adopt a statewide requirement. And I hope this information is helpful to you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you.
You mentioned the McKinsey study, 10 to 30%. What study have you got for the coast to indicate that the numbers are the same, similar, or more?
Co-chairs, representative, we don't have specific data showing the number of systems that fail just in the coastal zone in Oregon. There are studies around the country that give us that general 10 to 30%. And so the one that was done in the McKinsey just confirmed that you know, span of percent of systems.
When you follow up, when you talk about time of transfer, that's normally when it's transferred from one property owner to another through a sale. What about an inheritance?
The proposal that we're putting forth in the rulemaking would be any, we're calling it a transfer, so even if it was handed from, one property owner or one family member to another, that would need that inspection.
I would object to that strongly. I think it's going to run into a huge amount of expense, farm ranch communities that do hand their property down from generation. We just did a change on our inheritance tax to encourage those people to be able to maintain those within family ownership. And I think it'd be an added expense that probably you're not going to gain a whole lot from.
Thanks for flagging that. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we have a measure of the cost of the inspection?
Yes, co-chairs, representative, we have a technical review committee. It's a standing committee at DEQ that's made up of professionals in the industry. And they have informed us that the inspection could cost anywhere between $500 and $1,000. It depends, and that would actually include the cost of pumping out the septic tank. And that varies a little bit depending upon the area of the estate that you're in.
The process that got us here, and I really appreciate you taking us through, it's really helpful. I'm not happy about how we got here. I don't enjoy being told what to do by environmental groups that sue us and then hold us hostage for $2 million. I don't appreciate that. That's a technique I don't like. And far rather have you folks come in your position as those who are trying to keep us safe from unsafe systems and suggest that we need to do something as opposed to getting sued and then being held hostage. That's what's happening, and you explained it really well, and I appreciate that. It would be interesting to know if your department really thinks we need to do this or if we're just doing it for the $2 million. Mm-hmm. And so, hate to put you on the spot, but why don't you tell us your thoughts on that?
Okay. Thank you. So what I mentioned earlier, that we have the four components of a septic system: the siting, the design, the installation, and then the ongoing operation and maintenance. If you don't have all four of those, you're probably going to end up having problems with your septic system. All systems do need some type of maintenance. Could be just pumping out the septic tank every so often. There's more complex systems that require quite a bit more maintenance. So if that maintenance isn't performed, then you are going to end up having a problem. So this is one way to identify these things that may go unseen. And we've had a lot of situations where the property's transferred, new owner gets it, and they really don't know what they even have. So we do believe that it is an important thing.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Palmer, did you have a response to that as well?
Representative, I was just going to add, when the program looked at what other states were doing about how to ensure the regular proper operations of the system, we looked at time of transfer as being the most effective. But I would acknowledge to the committee that that doesn't mean it's the only approach that one could take, that it has to happen at time of transfer. It's just that based on what we could see, it was the most effective approach out there. So I wanted to add that.
Thank you so much. I don't know how many of these land sales a year in my office, wearing my lawyer hat. And every time I represent the buyer, I recommend that they have the septic system reviewed. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. The process that is being placed in action here is going to not discriminate between brand new houses that are selling again every 6 months or being flipped or whatever. Every time, someone's going to have to go get a $1,000 bill and pay. Usually what happens out in my part of the world is the septic system continues to work until it doesn't, then you get it fixed. That's kind of a pretty obvious thing. So exactly how this adds to that, exactly how much more we're now going to be forcing people to spend has probably not been studied. Instead, what's happened is we've jumped to the good, and now we impose a blanket requirement upon everyone. And so there's going to be a lot of inefficiency or a lot of higher cost in what we're trying to achieve than really we need. I don't know what the alternative is, but But those are the two problems I see with what we're about. One, we're being forced into it by an outside source, which I really dislike. And secondly, we don't know the true cost balanced against the good being achieved, as usual. That's not to say I'm opposed to what you're bringing to us. I'm just saying I wish we had a better measure of the cost.
Could I mention one thing about the cost? And you had mentioned the sale, 6 months, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood our proposal would be that inspection would be valid for a two-year period of time. So if it did sell again within that two-year period of time, you would not have to get another inspection.
If I may, the lifetime of a septic system is far longer than 2 years. The value is usually between 20 and 30 of a normal drain field system. So what's happening is you're going for 2 years. Okay, it's obvious. Yes. Thanks.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative Kenny-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the average amount of time at which a septic tank has problems? Like, what percentage have problems at 2 years, at 4 years? You'd think that 2 year would be based on some kind of evidence of likelihood of breakdown.
Yes, co-chairs, representative.
I'd be asking this many questions about septic tanks, but hopefully we make these decisions based on prevalence and data.
A septic tank itself, it has a variable. It could be 2 years to 20 years. It really depends upon what is going into it and medications and all sorts of things. And so that's a tough one to really pin down. We've heard averages of every 5 to 7 years it should be pumped out, but it could be as little as 2 years and as much as 20 years. The other types of systems that are out there, those that have pumps in them and that use mechanical parts, they're definitely going to need to be looked at least annually to make sure things are working right. So.
Further questions? Representative Thompson.
A couple of things. Are there any studies on the effectiveness of time of transfer inspections? I've got a lot of interest in coastal real estate, and in the area that I'm in over there, we have properties that transfer every year or two, especially right now. And there's other properties that probably 80 years. There doesn't seem to be a standard here for getting this done, if it's that important. If it were important, it seems to me the standard would be it has to be inspected every 5 years or something like that, because this is just dependent on a lot on economic circumstances as to how often a piece of property will transfer. And the second question is, what you would take $500 to $1,000 for an inspection. I assume the inspection must have some remedial value. So is this, we inspected it and you're okay, get out of our sight? Or is this, we've inspected it and this list of 35 things needs to be done right away? That's going to cost you another $5,000 that may not be critical, but be nice to upgrade the system. I mean, I can see where we can get some government intervention into this, which could really be onerous. If the system is working, it may not be a top-notch system, but if there are no operational problems at the moment, a lot of people don't have another $5,000 to go in and upgrade their system because the inspector thought it was a good idea if it's working.
Co-chairs, representative. The first question on the having something inspected every 5 years or something along those lines, we have looked at what other states have done, and even Dune City here in Oregon, they put in place one of those requirements. Every so often you need to have your septic system inspected. And what we found, even in Florida, they had a statewide mandate to inspect these things every so often, and it was met with a lot of resistance once it was implemented, and then that was actually repealed and they didn't actually go forward with it. So given that experience, we don't want to make the same type of mistake, so we're That's why we looked at the time of transfers being a good time to do that, and much, much better than what we have in place right now, which is nothing. And the second question, as far as what happens, you know, after you get that inspection, we can only require somebody to repair their system if it is indeed failing. So if there's just things that are, you know, recommendations that someone should do, they wouldn't be actually required to do that. It's only if the system was found to be failing and be discharging to the ground surface, you know, backing up in the home, something like that.
Well, one of my concerns would be septic system qualifications have changed dramatically in even like the last 20 years. And I have what was a high-end system when it was installed. I don't know under present standards if I'd inspected today, I don't need additional footage of drain field or whatever else to meet whatever the standard is today. Although my system is working flawlessly, I would object to someone coming in and saying, oh, by the way, you need to upgrade your system for no particular reason other than we changed the rules. I'd like to see more specification on cost and benefit and exactly what we're wading into here before we... I can't believe we're going to go out and do inspections and there's going to be no consequence of having done them. So there was an expectation here that we're going to find a lot of them we're going to do something about. Well, what is that about and what's the cost of it as opposed to what we're doing now, even if that is nothing.
Additional questions, Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot to ask you how the department will be participating in this. Is this a situation where part of the $500,000 is a fee back and to pay for the oversight and the additional work the department's going to have to do? I mean, where does that fit in, and how much is our state going to have to bungle up to do the bidding of this environmental group? Forgive me for throwing that in, Mr. Chair. I just couldn't avoid it.
Co-chairs, Representative, the plan right now would be to have the inspector, and we have a certification program for private inspectors. DEQ staff or county staff that are qualified could do those inspections, but we're anticipating that the private sector is going to do most of those inspections. And they would have, there would be a report that they would have to submit along with a fee, and that fee would be at the most $75. We're working with providing an electronic reporting system that's going to make it much easier for the inspector to submit their report and the fee. And if it was submitted electronically, it would be less than if it was submitted hard copy to one of our offices.
Mr. Chair? Right, well, and the rule, is it correct to say, in no way interferes with the sale? The sale goes forward regardless. It's not affected by this at all. It's not a condition of sale that you do this. I'm saying this. I'm hoping you're going to agree that sometime within a certain period of time after the sale, the report has to be received. I don't want this interfering, I'm hoping, with any sale. So people have to rush around, find somebody that's going to do the inspection before they can close. That's not in these rules, is it?
I'm glad that you asked that question. This is not going to be something that would have to happen before the actual transfer of the property. We have these. I'm trying to think here. I believe that our proposal was that in the rules is that it actually would. So disregard what I just said. I believe we changed it to require it be submitted prior to the sale. It was initially drafted within 30 days of the sale. And so we have proposed now in the rule that's going out for public comment that it be submitted prior to the sale. But the idea would be that the repairs, if there's repairs that need to be done or something like that, those don't need to be done before the sale. That just gives the buyer and the seller the opportunity to negotiate how they want to get the system repaired.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I'm tempted to get excited about this because it's a jobs bill for new inspectors, but probably not. My concern is for what it's doing. There's several concerns. I'm concerned for rural Oregon, which I want to get into. It seems to be a regular theme in this committee. But as we continue to flesh this out, I had to do that. The injury that we do to the realtors and to the transfer of property, which is, if you haven't heard, having some difficulty, it really concerns me. I understand that, you know, logically it's a nice vehicle that's attached to it. There's a whole lot of problems with it. But that's my first concern, is at this time we're doing this. Now, Representative Bence has said, you know, the gun's to our head because of the settlement. But short of that, this is, I think, a ill-advised way to get a solution. I want to go back to what you said earlier so we can talk about the settlement. And you may have said this clearly, but it wasn't clear to me at the time. But where in the settlement does it specifically require point-of-sale mandates? And then follow-up to that is, what other states actually are mandated by the feds to do this? You mentioned those as well.
Okay. Yes. Co-Chair Gilliam, as far as other states, there are, what we found is that Delaware, Iowa, Massachusetts, and New Mexico are all states that have statewide time of sale inspection requirements. And some are time of transfer, others are time of sale. And then there's a whole host of individual counties in the country that have their own individual inspection requirements. Up in Washington, particularly around the Puget Sound area, all of the counties up there have a time of sale inspection requirement. California is, they used to be county by county requirements, so you go across a county line, it's totally different requirements. And they just recently put in place a statewide set of rules. So there's not a lot of information on what they're doing in California.
But to interrupt you for a second, what I'm specifically interested in, because if it's county by county, it's not a federal mandate, I would assume. It would be a federal mandate would be for the entire state. So that's good information what states are practicing. But is it, do you know if those are a result of the federal pressure or the federal mandate in other states?
I'm not positive, but we can actually find that out.
I think it'd be interesting in light of the pressure that you describe from the feds on this subject. I said I was going to get back to this rural, you know, the quagmire of the Willamette Valley versus Representative Bence's Dust Bowl.
Well, I just thought quagmire was a more delicate term.
But he did say swamp. Rural property owners, were they represented on our, on the advisory group? Rural property owners, were the costs, the difference, you know, in cost in the rural area, was that considered? And lastly, have you explored, rather than a mandate, rather than more costs, rather than using the real estate transfer, what about employing, leveraging them for education, for positive sort of non-punitive methods of getting folks to do this? I think realtors are open to that. I think realtors already do that in many ways. So did we explore all that? Because all of those issues, I think, help protect this rural-urban divide on issues like this.
Co-Chair Gilliam, the advisory committee, and we can get a full list of everybody that was on there. We did have a representation from someone on the South Coast, and I'm not sure anybody on the North Coast, but we can certainly provide that. And as far as the non-punitive doing education and outreach, one of the struggles that the programs, the on-site program's been having, is that it's entirely fee-supported. So there's no real general fund money available to, you know, all of the fees come out of application, or all of our revenue comes from application fees. So that has made it a little difficult to provide that education and outreach. We did have in the 2011 session of Senate Bill 83 that was proposed to try to get at that issue of not only the education and outreach, but the training in rural areas of the state, as well as the low-interest loans and grants for homeowners to repair their systems. But unfortunately, we weren't successful with that bill. But I don't know what the future would hold. So,
to Jefferson, I had a sense you were going to say so.
No.
My last question, I guess, as I'm troubled by this, but is, can you tell us today, and if you can't get it to us, can you cite in the ORS where you all, DEQ, has the authority to implement this mandate?
And it is out of ORS 454, if I can find my notes.
Have it here?
Yes, I do have it here. I'm trying to find it.
454.615. Here we can discuss committee bills regarding ORS 454.615.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. And I just wanted to rephrase Co-Chair Gilliam's descriptive phrases regarding the Willamette Valley versus my area, or the Cranberry Bog, referred to as the Willamette Valley sometimes, or the New Zealand-like portion of Oregon, which is my district. But having said that, it seems to me that this prompt, this rule that's going to prompt the possible expenditure of whatever the replacement cost of a drain field is, which $20,000, big number.
Yeah.
I think you said there has to be the inspection and then you can close, but something had to happen to allocate that responsibility for that $20,000 expense. I throw $20,000 out because that was the last what it cost me the last time I did one. Maybe I paid too much. The question is, does the rule require that the responsibility and then the follow through be allocated before they can close? Is that how the rule is written? Or can you rest upon the fact that there was an inspection, your system is failing, go ahead and close, and maybe it'll take care of itself?
Co-chair's representative, that last thing you said was correct. So they could, even if the system is failing, they could close the property and then work out whatever deals they wanted to between the buyer and seller, and then the new owner could come in and do a repair permit.
No, excuse me, Mr. Chair. The question is, is there an obligation imposed upon one or the other? The state then follows up to make sure the system has been replaced. That's my question.
Yes, that is what we would use that fee for, is to follow up on any of the inspections that come in, the reports that come in that are deficient. We would then follow up on that and use the revenue from that fee to hire a staff person to do that work.
And the final question, yeah. I promise, yeah. If they don't, then the state sues them, or what does the state throw them out of the house? What happens?
Well, and we deal with failing systems all the time, and most people, they comply voluntarily, come in for a repair permit. If they don't, then sometimes we are unfortunately have to go through our compliance and enforcement program, and it starts very simply with, you know, the warning letters with opportunity to correct, and hopefully we'll gain compliance. But if we just don't, then we end up having to sometimes issue civil penalties and orders, but that's like a last resort.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say this, but I got to say this. When I moved to my house at the coast, North Coast, and it was 74, we had a septic, we moved into a farmhouse, septic tank had a pipe that went maybe from me to you out and directly ran into the river, directly. You could see stuff going like that. We called DEQ and said, wow, is that legal? And they said, yep, it is, grandfathered in. So we took it one step further and we asked to, you know, put in a septic system that would be more appropriate. And, I mean, this is a major river. And so we had somebody who came out literally with the book, walked around and said, this is what you have to do. And I know you guys weren't even born then, but, you know, this is a while ago. So basically they said, this is what we had, my husband and me and we didn't even have kids yet, you know, but we probably would have had, we had two. And, but we, they made us put in a system that would house, or where 12 people could live. Like, I could have had a small hotel there, but the house wasn't quite big enough. But we put the system in like that, pumped into a field and all that. But my point is that it was okay to continue dumping straight into the river with impunity. And, you know, I just find that weird. And so I'm wondering, and I think you're getting at this too. I mean, we many of us live in areas where there is no sewer. We'll never be a sewer system, ever. I can't even get cable TV. I can't even get anything but dial-up, you know. So I'm out there. So my point is, I guess, is there a way that you could deal with this differently in rural areas where it would be an incredible cost? You know, and our cost to us was huge. The tank itself was like a yogurt container made of concrete, but it's huge. And, you know, we obviously take care of it and all that, but that would be an inordinate amount of money for someone to have to put in a system like that. And I think they made us do it for so many more people because of the soil samples that they took. But I don't know how many more places in areas like mine are like that now, and that people didn't put in another. I mean, there are times when we've actually called DEQ because the river turns a weird color and it's somebody doing something upstream. And we're often just told to, you know, well, it'll wash away. Don't worry about it. Because that's the way it is out there some places. So I don't know if you could consider that when you're doing this, that not all places are the same. This is something we run into all the time, but I'm guessing in Portland, I don't know if there are, there might be some septic areas out in outlying Portland and some other cities where there's more, you're closer to whatever, but this just would be devastating to, you know, some areas. And in my area, there are places that have been on the market for years now, and when they do sell, I mean, we have a party because it's a big deal. So it's a big deal, and people are not getting what they'd like to get for their homes when they sell them, and this, I don't think this helps. So I know what you're trying to do, I get that point, but it seems to me like the realtors have something. I remember seeing something, you know, you either accept something as is or you get somebody to go, you get an inspector and check everything out and all that, but I think there are some things in place.
Co-chairs and representative, if I could just respond real quickly to that, that the intent of this is not to require upgrades if the system is not failing, because right now the system that's failing is required to be repaired. It's considered a public health hazard, and so they would need to repair that system. We find out about several of them through our complaints process, but a lot of them we don't know about. So we would not require anybody to just upgrade their system unless it truly was a failing system. And with our repair rules, it's a like for like. If somebody's trying to replace the system with a bigger system, a bigger sized system, that's not provided for in rule, and so some, you know, there may be, I'm not sure what would be happening there with the individuals out there doing the inspections, but that's not what our rules are about. And then the final thing I'd like to say is that, you know, selling a home and the cost of that home, the septic system is often overlooked, and so a $500 to $1,000 fee to inspect it certainly does, you know, seems like a lot of money, but when you take into consideration the cost of the overall home and ensuring that you have one of the basic, you know, infrastructure needs of a home, sewage disposal, that it's actually functioning properly, maybe you can see the value in that $500 to $1,000.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just briefly. So just so I'm clear on that, if we hadn't upgraded it and this rule were in place and DEQ came out, would they accept it? Would they have accepted it?
No. One of the things that we find is a lot of the inspections currently only focus on the septic tank, and they don't get out into the drain field area, and that's where I've had another situation where a a guy was roto-rootering a pipe, and he's just letting it go out into the field, and pretty soon he's seeing the trees along the creek start shaking. And again, it was just a direct discharge to the creek, and that was the end of the roto up, you know, up in the branches. So we're making sure that they're looking from the inlet of the tank all the way out to the drain field and making sure everything's okay. So in that situation, and in your situation, it would not have been permitted. It would have been an inspection report that was deficient, and that would have had to have been upgraded or, you know, repaired.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I really apologize, but okay, so I just had this come up with in a law-related case with the DEQ, and the drain field system had been buried for about 40 years. And so in order to figure out if the drain field was working, they had to find the end of it to do the pressure test. Couldn't find the end of it because, oddly enough, 40 years had passed, or 30 or 20, whatever it happened to be. Are you saying then that anybody that has this inspection has to have somebody go out and find the end of the drain field, now grown over for years with brush and everything else, and go out with a backhoe and dig around until they can find the end of it, and then do the pressure test? If that's what I'm hearing, this needs a whole bunch of work, because that is really expensive, just finding the thing and then doing the test. And I'm just saying, that's big money, because we didn't have a device that would allow us to find it. Now, as it was, after a whole bunch of work, and I want to credit the DEQ, we got kind of it resolved, but only after we proved it was going to cost us tens of thousands of dollars to find the thing. So this is a big deal, as my colleague says. And so, yes, I hope you get a lot of comments, and then maybe we get to hear about this again before the rule is actually adopted, I hope.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion from the committee? Representative Thompson.
What's the option of doing a rule like this for new construction moving forward? I just see this, I agree with Representative Bentz. In my own case, I know generally where the drain field is on rural acreage. It's in that field over there. I don't know where it is, and if I were to go inspecting for the end of the drain field, we're talking about, I better bring the archaeologists in, because, you know, in my case, the system hasn't failed. It works fine. I have it pumped every few years, whatnot. But I could get hit with a mandatory inspection, and I would have backhoes out there. And this could get extremely expensive and destructive to property, just looking for the end of the drain field, and hopefully you didn't dig into the middle of it. But I can see if we, in my case, because I've checked with the county, they do not have a map of my system on file anymore. It was built in the mid-70s, and I suspect that may be the case with a lot of rural sites. So I can see where if we set the requirement that from this date on, all new construction, all new installations have to be mapped, the maps have to be kept on file, and we will start inspecting those. I can see a huge problem in a lot of people not even having any idea where their septic system is on 5 acres.
Co-chairs, Representative, I do know our advisory committee talked about that, and they felt that especially those older systems that nobody knows about where they are probably the ones that we need to focus on, because the systems that were installed after 1974, January 1st was a statewide program, permits, and then you would have some record. You should have some record. It varied by county to county. Some had really good records. Others didn't have very good records at all. Nowadays, we do have really good records, so you can find out where things are without having to dig things up. So I think through the public comment period, we might find more comments like this.
I would think we need to have at least something in there that if you move forward with this and an inspection of the tank system and whatnot shows there's no, you know, this has been working, it appears to be working, we don't know where the drain field is, there's got to be a back out, that you don't have to go find that drain field if in fact there's no record of where it is, unless of course there's a problem. I mean, if funny stuff is bubbling up in the lawn, then we may want to look for further. But if the system appears to be functioning by all observations, man, I'm just looking at my case, it'd be a horror to take a backhoe out there and find the end of the, I have absolutely no clue how big that drain field is or where the end might be, but I destroy a lot of landscaping and roads even looking for it. And the repair work on just that part would be somewhere equal to replacing the drain. It might be cheaper to just replace the drain field.
Yes.
I've got a lot of land. I put the drain field somewhere else and hope that's not where the drain field is now. You know, but I see dollars rolling up on this real fast, and it's going to be a real hit to the value of real estate on the sale end. Well, if we start running up $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 at closure for something that is working or appears to be working.
If I could say that you know, that 10% to 30% of systems that are failing or need of some type of repair, maintenance, that sort of thing, there is that 70% that everything's fine and they don't need anything. And I do want to be honest with you guys and let you know that the rules as proposed would require those systems that don't have a record to find where those components are located.
Yeah.
And so through our public comment period and the rulemaking, we may find that is not our final product.
Some co-chairs, Representative Thompson, and to the other members of the committee, I think I'm hearing it loud and clear from the committee about the issue. If the septic tank or septic system is actually not failing, requiring people to do additional work where there's no problem. So I will be passing that along to the powers that be, because I understand that point and I understand the cost. I mean, we're already asking people, again, this is limited to certain counties in Oregon, but we're already asking them to pay a fee. Potentially adding on additional costs where there may not actually be a problem does seem to raise a good issue. So I want to make sure the committee knows that, taking note of that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your time, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Committee, thank you to all of you. I believe we have, Beth, do you want to give us details on what's happening later today?
We have a tour scheduled of the South Salem Bottle Drop facility, and if anybody needs a map, I've got a map, but otherwise we're scheduled to be there at 11:30, and it'll probably take about a half hour.
Yeah. The tour takes half an hour, or it takes half an hour to get to?
Oh, no, it takes 10 minutes to get there. Tour would be a half hour. Yeah.
I'd like the record to show I'm a card-carrying user of that facility. I put over 3,000 cans through it to date, and so if you have any questions from the consumer standpoint, and your question is, how can you put 3,000 cans through when there's a 300 can a day limit, right?
You read my mind.
Yeah, well, the answer is you just reset the machine and keep going.
That actually wasn't my question. It was, where are you getting three? I want to go over to the parties at your house. All right, with that, committee's adjourned.
Where is it?